Welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first-person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Red Beard, and today, in the studio, it's R.E.M. Going Green.
My friends that were on major labels at the time in the early 80s, the business was kind of at this weird cusp of time where no one that was doing A&R seemed to understand what they were signing, and they were trying to turn what they're signing into what they'd signed in 1974. So you got a lot of kind of like punk-ish rock bands that would get totally smoothed down. There's no reason to sign a punk band if you're going to smooth them down.
We walked in there and we took a look at the bass and the electric guitar and the drums and the same one we'd seen every day for the last 11 months. So we said, well, let's try something different. So we sat around in a little circle and Peter played mandolin and I would play the organ and Bill would play bass or electric guitar, I mean acoustic guitar. And, it was a lot more organic way to write songs than trying to shout at each other over 120 dB of electric guitar.
Hi, this is Mike Mills.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe with the best of R.E.M. In the Studio.
Hi, this is Peter Buck. Welcome back to In the Studio with Redbeard.
After five full-length albums and an EP, Athens, Georgia-based quartet R.E.M. hit the top 10 with their 1987 album Document. Up to that point, R.E.M.'s uncompromising music had come out on IRS Records, the biggest fish in that indie label's small pool. But Document was their swan song for that record company, joining the huge Warner Brothers Records for a long-term deal beginning with 1988's release entitled Green. Warner Brothers enticed R.E.M. with the promise of worldwide distribution, which paid off big time and immediately when the Green album was their first to be equally popular in the UK as well as America, eventually selling over 2 million copies, a first for R.E.M. The band's do-it-yourself approach to practically every aspect of their career did mean that there was no one else to blame if it didn't work, but they gladly accepted the risk-reward ratio because it afforded R.E.M. creative control of the music and artistic integrity on the business side. Would all of that be compromised now with success? I sat down in the studio with R.E.M. lead singer and songwriter Michael Stipe to inquire on how they apparently were vaccinated against the pitfalls of success, which is often much more insidious than failure.
Peter and Mike were really encyclopedic about music and musicians and the biographies of the people who they really admired as music fans. And they kind of very smartly said, if we're going to do this, these are the things that we need to know. This is what breaks up bands. This is what makes people start to suck. This is what makes people formulaic and irrelevant.
This one goes out to this one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I love. This one goes out to the one I've left behind. Another prom has occupied my time. This one goes out to the one I love.
I Love, live in Greensboro, North Carolina, on the 1989 Green Tour, which is now included on REM's deluxe edition of Green. The song originally appeared on the 1987 Document album, which was popular enough to land the band on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine that year, with the rhetorical headline question, America's Best Band? REM guitarist Peter Buck reacted.
Well, the one I always remembered was Alice Cooper with the snake. You know, that was when Rolling Stone still folded over. And I remember getting it because I subscribed it when I was like 13, and I got it in my mailbox, and I was like, wow, I had to hide it from my mom. You know, I wasn't sure she'd appreciate it. So you know, when I go, well, I'm right up there with Alice, I'm happy with that. Well, you know, the great thing about rock and roll, I mean, it's not classical music. On any given night, almost any band can be the best band on earth, which I that's what I like about it. It's not – that's why it's so hard to be a rock critic. You know, there isn't any way to say what's better. It's what you like. And I appreciate that. You know, I mean, I certainly wouldn't make any claim that we're the best band in the world or even in America or even in whatever city we happen to be in. But, you know, any band can be. And I've seen local bands that on any given night will just absolutely blow my mind. And you walk out going, wow, that's it.
By the time of REM's sixth album, Green, in 1988, REM's chafing at some of the Ronald Reagan-era U.S. policies were increasingly reflected in the band's lyrics and social activism. Again, Peter Buck.
Document particularly was kind of a chaotic look at all that. Green was kind of more spread out. But, yeah, I mean, I still feel the same way that whatever use we get out of the government is being cut back drastically so that rich people can get tax breaks and so that we can build weapons that we don't need. Look at the way they're cutting the budget now. I mean, no one has suggested that rich people should pay more taxes. I think, you know, I'm one of them. And I think we should. You know, I mean, I think it's really weird. And so what they're doing is cutting, you know, the aids to dependent children funds, you know? I mean, yeah, let's have a couple kids go hungry so we can continue to manufacture bombs. I just can't understand what's going on. So, you know, we do our political stuff on the side. I mean, we'd fund things because the government isn't going to do it. Well, I think it's kind of a great thing. I mean, in a way, you know, discussed with your government can turn out to be a very positive thing. You know, I mean, I think we've got a great constitution in this country. You know, no other country has what we have. I think that they're running it the wrong way. And until they see fit to take care of their citizens, then I guess a lot of us are going to have to do it. Not that I do that much. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm really a saint or anything. But lots of people who have regular jobs and don't have a lot of money, volunteer time, you know, cash when it's possible. I think that's a very positive thing. I think you can look at the government or the way it's kind of screwing things up and maybe if it makes people like us get a little bit more involved in the real world aspect of, you know, hunger and homelessness, then it's a good thing.
I lost myself. I think
we always like to think that we know what we're doing when we start, but that's just not the way it works for anybody, I don't think. Generally, when we've written about 20 songs, and we're kind of at the point where we start realizing which ones are good and which ones aren't, and probably that means a couple weeks into the studio work, and then you start realizing, oh, okay, this record's going to be, and especially at the very, very end, the last couple weeks, you just when you start defining it, doing all the mixing things, a lot of times you just get slapped in the face with what you've done, because until then you don't really know. You know, because you do the records, and you always, every record you do, everyone in this end of the business thinks they've made a great record. Nobody means to make a bad one. Nobody tries to make a mediocre record. You know, they do the very best they can, and it, you'd be less than human if you didn't fool yourself a little bit and think that they were maybe better than they are, or at least you hope they are. And so when we go back and play them, I actually kind of go, gosh, you know, these are really good songs. They hold up.
I've debated over the lyrics to Orange Crush for 15 years now.
Don't hurt yourself. I have no idea what it's about.
That was Michael Stipe talking about REM's number one, Orange Crush. Up next, REM's Mike Mills joins Peter Buck and Michael to demystify the REM approach to success. Follow In The Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and terrific live REM hard-to-find performances at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, with Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills.
Hi, this is Mike Mills.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe.
Hi, this is Peter Buck. Welcome back to In The Studio with Redbeard.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's the 5th anniversary of REM's first worldwide hit album, Green. When talking to REM's bass player and vocalist Mike Mills after a remarkable 25 years playing together, I wondered if he ever imagined that their little college garage band would stay intact into the 21st century.
You know, I never probably imagined it because I just didn't really care to. I didn't think that far ahead. I mean, we were never a band that had grand schemes or goals, you know, particularly. We were a band that always knew what we didn't want to do. You know,
and what was that?
Well, we didn't want to do anything that felt wrong, just as a general feeling. I mean, Peter was enough of a rock and roll archivist even at that point, and I'd read a fair amount myself, and we had an idea of what looked bad and what was bad and what some of the pitfalls could be. In terms of the advice you take from people, thoughts on what you have to do to become successful. So we sort of took everything on a case-by-case basis, and we never had these long-range plans for anything. So, no, I never imagined that 20 years on I'd be doing it with the same guys, but I never imagined I wouldn't either. You know, I always knew I'd be playing music in some form or fashion, and
I think that's the most significant thing, probably, is that you knew that you were going to make music your life.
Right, yeah. Well, it became pretty obvious pretty quickly I wasn't really suited for much else.
What is certain, though, is the creative contribution by original drummer Bill Berry, according to Mike Mills.
One thing Bill was really good at for us was editing. He kept the songs shorter, and as they should be. So that's something we've had to learn to do without Bill, is to edit ourselves and not to get self-indulgent. Because we've always appreciated the beauty of a concise, 3 to 4 minute pop song. And
you sure have.
Yeah, and I think that's essential. And sometimes you can lose sight of that. You know, you don't want to become art damaged and start putting, 7 minute prog rock songs on there. So Bill was always real good at keeping that from happening.
Stand in the place where you live. Think about direction. Wonder why you have it now. Stand in the place where you were. Now face west. Think about the place where you live. Wonder why you haven't before. If you are confused, check with the sun. Carry a compass to help you along. Your feet are going to be on the ground. Your head is there to move you around. So stand in the place where you live. Now face north. Think about direction. Wonder why you haven't now. Stand in the place where you were. Now face west. Think about the place where you live. Wonder why you haven't before. Your feet are going to be on the ground. Your head is there to move you around. Wishes of trees, the trees would be falling. Listen to reason, the season is calling. Stand in the place where you live. Now face north. Think about direction, wonder why you have it now. Stand in the place where you were. Now face west. Think about the place where you live. Wonder why you have it before. If wishes were trees, the trees would be falling. Listen to reason, reason is calling. Your feet are going to be on the ground. Your head is there to move you around. So stand. Now face north. Think about direction, wonder why you have it now. Stand. Now face west. Think about the place where you live. Wonder why you haven't. Stand in the place where you live. Now face north. Think about direction, wonder why.
Between saturation exposure of the video on MTV and heavy airplay on radio, REM's Stand from the 1988 Green Album was a big mainstream hit. But I had to ask REM lead singer Michael Stipe about a curious reaction by some early fans.
I used to get a smattering of calls on the request line back in 88 when I would play Stand from just a few listeners claiming to be REM fans, claiming to speak on your behalf. They would deride the song and urge me not to play it, and I would be very confused by that. Where were these so-called fans getting the notion that you wanted to disown your then-current song?
Well, from the same place that I, as an 18-year-old, thought that Blondie had, quote, sold out when they did Heart of Glass, and I dismissed them as a sellout band that I would have nothing to do with, and I wasn't interested in anything that they did from that moment forward. And of course, I look back at that record and realize how very brilliant and how very ballsy it was for them to integrate disco into their music. That took balls like church bells, and they did it, very successfully. It's a great record. Did I recognize or realize that as an 18-year-old? No. I just saw my heroes doing something that I thought was stretching further beyond. You know, people get very territorial about the things that inspire them and the things that they enjoy, whether it's music or other mediums and the people that create those mediums. And so I'm not surprised that you got a lot of calls from people saying, don't play this, it's crap. And
actually, it wasn't a lot of calls.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not surprised that you got some calls.
REM guitarist-songwriter Peter Buck explains how REM could use four different producers on their first five albums and still sound like REM every time.
It's really funny because starting a band, I mean, nobody helps you, you know, generally. I mean, your parents don't want you to do it. The club owners don't want you to be in their club giving them the demo tape. Nobody wants you to do it. So you have to have this great self-confidence and ability to really push yourself. So I find it really shocking that then people signed a record deal and didn't let people make decisions for them. Because I know what I'm doing. I mean, I've done this a lot longer than most people have done their job. And I've certainly been around REM more than, you know, and I know what we should do. It's great when people give us suggestions that you know, we work with Scott Litt a lot, and he always helps us, but he doesn't tell us, well, you know, you'll sell a million records if you do this. He always just says, yeah, this would be pretty wild. Let's try it. And I'm really interested in experimenting. I just don't want to have a formula that to follow. I mean, although the English record company people used to say that, like around the time of Murmur, that dance music was big in England, so we really need to do more of a dance record. And I was like, well, you know, I'm not really sure what you expect us to do in the way of making a dance record. I mean, we're kind of a folk rock band from Georgia. I mean, you know, I just don't really get it. Well, it's really short-sighted. I mean, we've always felt that, well, we're going to be around in 10 years. We don't have to have a hit tomorrow. And so many of the record company people want a hit today because that's their job. I understand that, and it's a business, and I do the business. You know, I'm in it, I'm involved in it. My business is different from their business. My business is that this is something I do, and I do it well, and I'd probably do it for another 10. So it's not imperative to me to have a hit. And if we put out a record that is something we really want to do and it doesn't sell as well as the previous one, which Automatic didn't sell as well as Out of Time. I mean, it sold 8 million instead of 10 million. But that's fine. You know, I mean, I accept the fact that, well, you know, it didn't sell as well, but it's the record we wanted to make. And it wasn't a real commercial record. It was just a pretty great record.
This is not
Original longtime REM drummer Bill Berry slamming away, powering the band through Turn You Inside Out on the Green Album. Still to come, Peter Buck, Michael Stipe, and Mike Mills all return to reveal how pivotal some of Green's more acoustic numbers directly influenced their next album to include one of the biggest songs of the 90s decade. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online, rarities at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio on the anniversary of REM's Green.
Hi, this is Mike Mills.
Hi, this is Michael Stipe.
Hi, this is Peter Buck. Welcome back to In the Studio with Redbeard.
Again, thank you all. Lead guitarist Peter Buck was probably showing some symptoms of creative mission creep when he made headlines and raised a few eyebrows at the beginning of the 90s with the quote, "All forms of popular music are dead."
What I meant was that the media tends to suck things up so quickly that, like in 1956, rock and roll was weird, and it was still weird in 1961 because it was, you know, it was dangerous, it was scary. You know, rap music has been around, what, years, and you're seeing commercials and, you know, selling Sprite and McDonald's.
McDonald's,
and
yeah,
that tends to take away a lot of the power and immediacy. But, you know, a really good artist can take any foreign music and turn it into something exciting. I mean, the Marcellus Brothers are kind of reinventing the 50s, you know? And if you'd asked a jazz fan 10 years ago, well, do you think cool jazz is going to be really in 1991? No one would have thought that, but they're managing to, you know, breathe life into it. You know, just the same as a good band can do to rock and roll. Neil Young does it. Sonic Youth does it. We do it.
You mentioned Neil Young. The song Country Feedback on this Out of Time, that could have come off of American Stars and Bars in 1976 or 77.
You know, I think the guitar is kind of similar to stuff that he does. I'm not a very fast guitar player, and neither is he. I don't think you really need to be fast. That's just kind of turn up to 11 and start whacking at it, you know. And I don't really follow the structure of the song. Sometimes I play a melody, sometimes I play a harmony, sometimes I just make noise.
That's what Neil does.
Yeah, but he's one of my favorite guitar players, and you just never know what he's going to do. I mean, you know, his solos sometimes don't make total sense in the song. Sometimes it's just like, what is he thinking of? And that's what you like about soloing guitars is that air of kind of mystery and excitement. What's coming next? In most bands, when they come from solo, I mean, you can just about sketch it out on a graph.
Yeah, yeah, you kind of know where it's going.
I sit at my table and wage war on myself. It seems like it's all for nothing. I know the barricades and I know the mortar. Recognize the weapons, use them well. This is my mistake, let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down. Rich understanding of my finest defenses. I proclaim the claims are left unstated. I demand a rematch. I decree stalemate. I divine my deeper motives. I recognize the weapons. I practiced them well. I fitted them myself.
raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down. This is my world, and I am a world leader. Pretend this is my life, and this is my time. I have been given the freedom to do as I see fit. It's high time I raise the walls that I've constructed. It's amazing what devices you can sympathize. This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down. Fill in the mortar, you fill in the harmony, you fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
World Leader Pretend appeared on REM's 1988 Green Album. Pretending was something the collective band members were never accused of when it came to the world's big issues, according to lead singer and lyricist Michael Stipe.
Over the course of 23 years, being politicized simply by the amount of travel that we've done as a band, when those moments come, I feel like the opportunity is lost if I don't say something or if I don't try to capture that time. It's an interesting time for the U.S., certainly, and one that we'll see if, as we all think, everything has sped up in the course of our lifetimes, let's say since mid-century, 1950s. Certainly, my grandmother's being born in 1904 without a television or a motor vehicle, and dying 87 years later with a man on the moon and nuclear abilities on each side of the line. Who knows what it'll be when I'm 87? I think politics might speed up in the cycles that politics go through, in American politics certainly, because it's very much celebrity and media fueled and driven, might speed up so that what would take 8 years to come full cycle, to move from one extreme to the other, and that's really basically how it moves, I think, might move down into a 4 or even a 2 year cycle. It really depends on the economy. And that's what it's down to.
Green Album's international success allowed REM to go on a lengthy world tour, but the repetitive sameness required to perform on a modern-day tour had them all physically exhausted and creatively stilted, according to first Peter Buck, then Mike Mills.
We did Green, which was kind of like a big record. I mean, big drum sounds, big guitar sounds, even the acoustic stuff sounded kind of big, you know? And we kind of wanted to make a little bit more human-sounding record. We talked about strings on the tour and saying, gee, wouldn't it be nice to use a lot of wood instruments, acoustic instruments? While we were writing, you know, I kept a little notebook of, you know, before we have titles, it's like, well, there's the fast one, then there's the new fast one, then there's the slow one, and then there's the one in three-quarter time. And someone would go, gee, why don't we put cellos here? So then I'd write, you know, new song, cellos at bridge, that kind of thing. And by the time we kind of got the songs worked out, I had two or three pages of notes for possible string ideas. It was just, while we were creating these things, it seemed logical.
We were very fortunate, too, that we'd gotten to know Mark Bingham, who arranged most of the strings on this record, because we'd never worked with a 9-piece symphony string section before, And if I had had to write out the charts, it would have taken me about 6 years. So we were really fortunate that we got him. He did a wonderful job, and he came up with some of the most amazing string parts I've ever heard.
It's just icing on a wonderful cake that y'all baked. It really, really is nice.
We walked in there, and we took a look at the bass and the electric guitar and the drums and the same one we'd seen every day for the last 11 months. So we said, well, let's try something different. So we sat around in a little circle, and Peter played mandolin, and I would play the organ, and Bill would play bass or electric guitar, I mean acoustic guitar. And, it was a lot more organic way to write songs than trying to shout at each other over 120 dB of electric guitar. Plus, you write different songs. You get a lot warmer sound, a more intimate sound. When you write on a mandolin, you don't write big crashing guitar songs because it's impossible. So we got a little more of a softer sound on some of these songs because we wrote them like that.
Well, now Peter did, I don't play anything, so, and particularly nothing with strings, but did you just pick up the mandolin one day and you could play it, or is it considerably different from the six-string guitar?
I don't know. If you could find your way around a guitar, you could find your way around a mandolin.
Really?
I'm not really competent on mandolin, although I'm working and I'm taking lessons and stuff. But I actually found one in New York, and I just liked the shape of it. It was this Italian mandolin, and it was just very odd-looking, and it was cheap. And well, I'll buy that, and I'll tune it up and see what happens. And I use it as a writing tool more than anything else. I don't think I could really sit in with someone else on mandolin. But for writing my own songs, it's great because you just kind of come up with things you wouldn't normally come up with. I tend to wander into keys that I wouldn't play in. And I use F all the time in mandolin. I never write songs in F on guitar. Huh. It's just F is a fun key on mandolin. It's really not a fun key on guitar.
Oh, life, it's bigger. Distance in your eyes. Oh no, said too much. Set it up. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spot. Light, losing my religion. Trying to keep eye on you, like a hurt, lost, and blinded fool. Oh, oh no, I've said too much. I set it up. Consider this. Consider this. Hint of century. Consider this. The slip brought me to my knees, failed. What if all these fantasies come flailing around? Now I've said too much. I thought that I heard you laughing. I think I thought I saw you try. But that was just a dream. That was just a dream. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion. Trying to keep up you
said too much. I haven't said enough. I thought that I heard you laughing. I thought that I heard you sing. I think I thought I saw you try. That was just a dream. Try, that was just a dream, just a dream, just a dream.
Losing My Religion, originally from Green's follow-up in 1991 entitled Out of Time, will probably remain a touchstone of the time for many, many years to come. Here's REM's lead singer and lyricist Michael Stipe.
Yeah, pop culture, particularly in the U.S., comes and goes, and everything moves in cycles as things do, which we all realize as we grow older and wiser, whether it's politics or pop culture or music or what have you, people's taste, radio, and... where we never, I would argue, never made giant steps to make ourselves a viable hit-making American band for American radio. Radio came to us, and to my count, probably three times in 23 years. Pop culture just swung into our little stubborn trajectory. And we were in the same orbit a couple of times. The most clear and obvious time would be Losing My Religion, where we wrote a song that didn't have a chorus and had a mandolin as a lead instrument, and for some reason captured the imagination of just about every single person who was breathing on this earth. And that's not a standard that I think wisely you could hold yourself up to for whatever song you put out next or whatever record you put out next. To attempt to do that, I think probably would have been the death of this band, or certainly the creative kind of death of this band. And so we kind of merrily went along our stubborn little route, and in doing so, American pop culture moved in a very different direction. And I think the ways, and again we're back to distribution, the ways that people who are not music fans and go out and seek music, the way that they hear it or become aware of it is mostly through radio and television. It went off on its little path, and we went off on our little path. Our little path happened to take in a big chunk of the world, and there's a lot of people out there for whom REM didn't mean a whole lot in the 1980s, but suddenly with Losing My Religion, here was a band that had been around for some time, had a pretty good catalog of music, and had a lot of promise. And that's the path that we took. That's the direction that it went in. No regrets. It's not really something you can manufacture or create. You know, it just it that stuff just happens. I had always wanted to have a song that would be considered the song of the summer. As it was, that song kind of became the song of the year, I think. It really did kind of take off. Well, I don't know. That's not for me to say, certainly. But thank you for what you said. You can't create the kind of environment where something like that could happen. I think a lot of people try to, and you wind up with kind of substandard, forgettable stuff that's really written for very different reasons than why we write what we write, and or at least we try to write what we write. So if we chose Losing My Religion as the standard by which all other singles would be released, then we'd be really kind of screwing ourselves in the head, certainly, and I think cutting ourselves and our audience short of the potential that we have as songwriters and as a group. It didn't take a real long time to figure that out, that it was a fluke. It was a complete fluke. And I'm really happy it happened.
Oh.
got my Orange Crush.
REM's first number one, Orange Crush, live on the 1989 Green Tour from Greensboro, North Carolina. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Mike Mills. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.